Don Machholz, and you are listening to Looking Up with Don. This is Looking Up with Don podcast, episode number 2 for the week of January 15th, 2020. And yes, I have discovered music. The related website for this podcast is donmachholz.com. That is spelled donmachholz.com. Two H's. What's up in the sky this week? As our week begins on Wednesday, January 15th, the moon is in the morning sky rising about midnight, and you'll find it rising about an hour later each night. So that means the evening sky is moonless, and this allows observing of faint objects each night. When you step outside in the evening this week, you will see the planet Venus in the southwest. It's a bright, star-like object. And don't forget to look to the east and check out the red star Betelgeuse in the constellation Orion. It's dimmer than usual, and this is a topic that we discussed in some detail last week. In the morning sky, the crescent moon lines up with the planet Mars and the red star Antares on the morning of January 20th. Compare the colors of Mars and Antares. And while you're out in the morning, you might see the planet Jupiter rising in the southeast in the pre-dawn sky. It has now come out from behind the sun and will be rising earlier each morning. The thin crescent moon will be near the planet Jupiter on January 22nd. If you have a pair of binoculars in your house, please go get them while listening to this next segment. In a few minutes, I would like to explain to you how they can be used for astronomy. This week, you should be able to see the International Space Station in the evening sky for the Northern Hemisphere, and you'll see it in the morning sky if you live in the Southern Hemisphere. You can go to the website heavens-above.com, enter your location, and find out where and when to see it. The website again is heavens-above.com. Let's talk for a few minutes about the Starlink satellites. Now, what is Starlink? Starlink is a group or constellation of man-made satellites that are being assembled and launched by SpaceX, which is run by Elon Musk. Now, this group of satellites is intended to produce a space-based internet service. The first 60 satellites were launched on May 24th, 2019, and the second set of 62 were launched on November 12th of 2019. The third set was launched this past week. By the mid-2020s, about 12,000 Starlink satellites are expected to be orbiting the Earth, with a possible extension of up to 42,000 satellites. Now, of the first 12,000 satellites, more than half will be orbiting at a height of 210 miles. This is a bit lower than the International Space Station, which is at about 250 miles, while the other two sets of Starlink satellites will orbit at 340 miles and 710 miles. Originally, the only objection was about the amount of space junk orbiting the Earth. It is getting crowded up there, but space is large and the chances of collisions are still fairly slim. However, after the first set was launched, and then the second set, and now the third set, ground-based astronomers began to complain about the bright streaks these satellites leave on their images as the satellites traveled through their fields of view. To the visual observer, a satellite, and there's many satellites up there, but a satellite appears as a star-like object moving slowly across the sky. In a telescope, they appear brighter and move faster. I've observed more than 17,000 satellites while comet hunting over the past 45 years. And to the visual observer, the satellites are not generally a big bother. In fact, satellites and meteors are generally pleasant to watch as they travel through the sky. A few years ago, after a public star party, one of our guests said that watching the Iridium satellite was the highlight of the night for him. Better than Jupiter and better than Saturn. Okay, I get it. Those Iridium satellites not only moved across the sky, they would brighten as predicted. Sadly, the Iridium satellites are gone. They've all been taken out of orbit. But we do have the Starlink satellites, and to the casual observer, it is exciting to watch them as 60 satellites follow each other across the sky. At a public star party, it might just be the hit of the night. One suggestion for the sightings of drone-like objects in Colorado these last few weeks is that people might be watching the Starlink satellites. Other people are disputing that theory. But if you would like to see the Starlink satellites yourself, go to this website, heavens-above, and get the predictions for the Starlink satellites, and go out and watch them with the unaided eye or with binoculars. Until recently, the only visual observer I'd heard complain about the night sky being ruined by satellites was the late American comet discoverer and variable star observer, Leslie Peltier. He discusses his contempt for artificial satellites ruining the sky several times in his book, Starlight Nights, that was published in 1967. Lately, there has been some complaint about the Starlink satellites potentially ruining the nighttime sky for visual observers who value the dark sky. Some astronomers see the satellites as being like light pollution, which brighten up the sky and makes it more difficult to enjoy the natural darkness of the nighttime sky. However, I've never heard astronomers complain about the International Space Station ruining their dark sky, and that's at least 40 times brighter than the Starlink satellites. Now, for those imaging the sky, either with the electronic equipment or with photography equipment, making time exposures, each satellite leaves a streak of light. In fact, they photobomb the image. These are presently hard to remove without removing some of the sky behind each streak. That subtracts some of the data, that is the image that the astronomer is seeking to observe and analyze. Presently, there are some workarounds that may not be so easy as more satellites are launched. First, the astronomer can avoid imaging the part of the sky at the time the satellites are predicted to pass through. That will become more difficult as more satellites populate the sky and occupy more diverse orbital paths. Secondly, the astronomer can image the sky in the opposition area where the satellites are much less bright since they are in the Earth's shadow. However, this limits the parts of the sky that can be imaged. Another suggestion is to pause the imaging as a satellite enters a field, then resume the imaging a couple of seconds later after the satellite has left the field. A final suggestion, and one that may likely be tried, is to paint or coat future satellites black so that they'll reflect less light. But even then, that does not eliminate the problem completely, as they will still reflect some light. So here we have a dispute between those who want to push the boundaries of technology with space-based internet, and who would complain about having space-based internet, and those who value the darkness of the night sky. This dispute is somewhat similar to the fight against light pollution, where one side uses technology to light the night, and the other side wishes to preserve the darkness of the night sky. There's no court, there's no judge to which one can take the case of the night sky. No one has authority to tell SpaceX that they cannot launch satellites. There is some dialogue and some hate spewed towards Elon Musk on social media. between the opposing parties, and it appears at this time that the best that astronomers can hope for is dimmer satellites in the future. Two short stories about binoculars. When I taught the adult education astronomy class at Sierra College in Northern California, which was a six-week course, on the second week, I had the students bring their binoculars to the classroom. By the end of the evening, they were using them to find astronomical objects, and they were impressed with what they could do. Number two, when a parent asks what telescope to buy for their child, I suggest they first have their child learn the sky with the unaided eye. It might take a few weeks to learn some of the constellations and the locations of the planets. I then suggest they get some binoculars and have their child use them on the night sky. Finally, get a telescope. This formula has worked for me and for countless others involved in astronomy. Many of you already have binoculars. I don't care if they're camouflaged, waterproof, shockproof, or dropproof. Let's get some use out of them. Take out those binoculars now and begin becoming familiar with them. Let's take a look at a pair of binoculars. On one end, we have two large lenses. Those are known as the objective. That's where the light comes in. On the other end of the binoculars are two smaller eyepieces. They're called the eyepieces, and they are the parts that you hold up to your eyes. Between those two sets of optics, inside the binoculars are usually some prisms that will bend the light through the tube of the binoculars so that the light will exit the eyepiece into each eye. If you look at the faceplate of the binoculars, you'll usually find a set of numbers such as 7X35 or 7X50. Some binoculars might be 10X50, 10X80, or 11X70. Those numbers tell us something about the binoculars. The first number is the magnification, how much it magnifies the image. So 7X35 magnifies an object 7 times. 20X80 magnifies the object 20 times. We don't usually read it as 7x, we usually read it as 7 by. So my 7x35s, we usually refer to that as 7 by 35s. 20x80, we refer to that as 20 by 80s. Now the second number is the size of the aperture, the front lenses, in millimeters. A millimeter is a measurement of length. 25 millimeters is about 1 inch, 50 millimeters is 2 inches, 75 millimeters is 3 inches, and 100 millimeters is about 4 inches. So if you have a pair of binoculars that are 7 by 35s, they magnify 7 times, and the aperture, the front lenses, are each 35 millimeters across, or almost 1.5 inches across. 7 by 50s magnify 7 times with a 2-inch aperture. A good pair of binoculars to have for the night sky has between 5 and 10 magnification. If you have more than that much magnification, you will probably need a tripod on which to hold the binoculars, otherwise it become too difficult to hold. The more magnification, the larger the aperture, the heavier the binoculars are. So the disadvantages of the higher magnification is you generally have a smaller field of view and the binoculars are heavier and more difficult to hold steady. For astronomy, we like to have a fairly large aperture, 7 by 50s. You can see more objects than you can with 7 by 35s. And 20 by 80s, you can see more objects than you can with 7 by 50s. Don't feel bad if you don't have the most powerful or largest binoculars. Let's just learn to use what we have so that we can see what we can see. So, looking closely at your binoculars, the two barrels are attached by a hinge. This is known as the center hinge, and by moving it along the center hinge, you can change the distance between the two eyepieces. This is necessary because the distance between people's eyes varies with each person. It's usually anywhere between 55 and 65 millimeters, and in order to use binoculars properly, we want the eyepieces to be aligned with your eyes. So let's suggest this now. Holding the binoculars in your hands, adjust the distance between the pupils so they line up well with your eyes. Bring the eyepieces up to your eyes and move them until you have a merged image through the binoculars. We will be fine-tuning this a little bit later. Next, look closely at the eyepieces. If both of them rotate, then we will be focusing them one way, but if only one of them rotates, we'll be focusing them in a different way. Let's assume that both of your eyepieces rotate. In this case, we're going to focus them on a distant object. Generally speaking, binoculars have trouble focusing at closer than 40, 50 feet, depending upon the binoculars. You get too close and they don't focus on the objects. They're designed for objects that are distant, and infinity is what's considered to be the stars and planets and so on. So hold the binoculars up to your eyes and look at something that's really, really distant. Cover the front objective on the right side with your right hand and rotate the eyepiece on the left side until that object is in focus. Once you focus the left eye, just do the reverse. Put your left hand over the left objective so you can only see out of the right eye, and then rotate the eyepiece so that the right eye is focused. When you are done, look through both eyepieces and see that everything is focused, and also you can readjust, if you need to, the distance between the eyepieces by using the center hinge. Now, most binoculars, however, only one eyepiece will rotate, and that's the one on the right-hand side. Those binoculars have a center thumb screw attached to the hinge. That thumb screw, as it's rotated, will move both eyepieces away from the objective or closer to the objective in order to focus them. So if you have the type of binoculars which has the center thumb screw, this is how we're going to focus them. Hold them up to your eye and look at something distant. Cover the right side and use the thumb screw to focus your left eye. Once you have the left eye focused using the thumb screw, let's do the reverse. Put your left hand then over the left barrel, so now you're only looking through the right side. But instead of moving the thumb screw this time, move the individual eyepiece right adjacent to your right eye to make the object sharp. When you're done doing that, look through both barrels to make sure that the object that you're looking at is in focus, and readjust the distance between the eyepieces if you need to get a good sharp view. If both of your eyes are in focus and you are still seeing double, then the binoculars is in need of repair because the barrels are not aligned with each other. Repairing binoculars is a bit more advanced, and we'll be covering that in a future podcast. If you wish to buy a pair of binoculars, be sure that they can be returned if they fail your field test. And then take them out on a clear night and look at some stars. When fully focused, the stars should appear as points of light when they are in the center of the field of view. Now, at the very edge, they may blur a bit, and this is normal. Also, make sure that a bright star produces no ghost images, that is, internal reflections, and that it is not multicolored when you view a star overhead. Now, if you're looking at a star near the horizon, you might pick up some some different colors, but if you look right overhead, you should not have pink and blue and orange all mixed in the color of the star. Now, if the binoculars fail those tests, take them back and try another pair of binoculars or perhaps another model. This week's Naked Eye Challenge. Last week, we looked up in the evening sky and we located the great square of Pegasus. This week, we're going to count the number of stars we can see inside that square. So, go out and look at the square of Pegasus. It should be high in your western sky after it gets dark at night. It was pointed out on last week's star map, and it's also indicated on this week's star map, which you can get from my website. Wait a few minutes until your eyes get accustomed to the darkness, and then count the number of stars you can see within the square of Pegasus. Now, don't count the four bright stars that form the square, but all the stars you see in the square. Two of them are fairly easy. As you go beyond those two, you'll see that they're fainter and fainter. Write down the number of stars that you see, and we'll talk about that next week. The binocular challenge for this week is to go out and observe the Pleiades, which is also known as the Seven Sisters. It's fairly high in the eastern sky, and it is also identified on this week's star map, which you can get from my website. Look at it with binoculars. It should appear as a Little Dipper, but it is not really the Little Dipper. It just appears as one. Now notice that the stars are blue. This is an open star cluster, one of the brightest in the sky. If you have real dark skies, you might notice some nebulosity or fogginess around some of the brighter stars. Assuming the fogginess is not around all the stars, which would indicate dirty optics or a bad atmosphere, you are seeing something real, dust and gas near those bright stars. By the way, the light you see left those stars about 440 years ago. That is, it is about 440 light years away. The telescopic challenge for this week. Let's look at one of the Messier objects, one of the 110 galaxies, clusters, and nebula that comet hunter Charles Messier cataloged more than 200 years ago. Each object has its own number from 1 to 110. This week's target is M1, also known as the Crab Nebula. It is on the star map associated with this podcast, and you can find it on my website. M1 is a supernova remnant, and it exploded in the year 1054, or at least that's when we saw it explode, and it's about 6,500 light years from us. Through the telescope in a dark sky, it appears ghostly, that is not much brighter in the center. See what type of shape you can make it out to be. Today's fun fact, the Messier catalog consists of 110 galaxies, clusters, and nebula that are scattered throughout the sky. In late March each year, from mid-northern latitudes, it's possible to find and observe all 110 of the Messier objects in one night. This is known as a Messier marathon, and we'll discuss it on these podcasts in future weeks. Once again, the related website for this podcast is donmachholz.com. That is spelled donmachholz.com, two H's. God willing and pod willing, I'll be back next week for another episode of Looking Up with Don. We will discuss the planet Venus, now visible in our evening sky. We'll be explaining the brightness scale known as magnitude, and how to observe a comet that will be high in our evening sky. Thank you for listening. See the sky this week. I'll see you next week.